which is Doe versus State of Nebraska. Is it Mr. Lutz Preford? Good morning to you, and Mr. McWilliams. Good morning to you. Are you going to split your time?
No,
Your Honor. Okay. Are you arguing, Mr. Lutz Preford? Yes. Thank you. And Mr. Campbell, good morning to you also. Do any counsel have any questions?
No, we do not.
Let us proceed then, Mr. Lutz Preford. You may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court. Zachary Lutz Preford on behalf of John Doe. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 1 minute and 30 seconds for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case all comes down to second chances, specifically the second chances that the legislature saw fit to create when it amended the Nebraska Criminal History Act in 2018. Those amendments to the Criminal History Act created a situation where individuals like John Doe have the ability to, after receiving a pardon and a court order sealing their records, deny that they have a criminal felony history. It also created an obligation upon the state, a specific duty, where those same individuals who have a sealed criminal history and a pardon, that the state may not disseminate their records in response to a number of situations, and pertinent to this case, employment requests.
Does the statutory duty ever apply to a private individual?
I believe that it would still apply to a private individual because the court order sealing the records is going to provide that there can be no dissemination of the records. Now, obviously, that creates problems where maybe the individual or the entity does not exist within the state of Nebraska, but I do think the right would still be charging upon the individual who is not the state.
Thank you.
Now, within the confines of this case, the issues before this court are effectively twofold. One, whether or not there is a private duty created by the statutory scheme of the Criminal History Act, particularly as it was amended in 2018, and second, whether or not Mr. Doe is an individual who suffered an injury. Looking to that first issue, whether or not there is a private duty. This court has addressed the issue of statutes creating private duties in the Claypool case. And in Claypool, this court created a test. Three parts. First, does the state or does the statute have a protected class of individuals? That is true here. There is a protected class of individuals, people who have received a pardon, whose records have been sealed. It is a narrow group of people. Second is whether or not the harm that is attempted to be protected, the same that the statute contemplates. And the answer to that is, again, yes. You can look to Senator Lindstrom's testimony as cited in our brief that this is designed to protect people who have received a pardon, but on a day-to-day factor, it's effectively useless to them because they can't return to the workforce. They are barred by getting a job because in spite of the pardon, in spite of the sealed records, they continue to be in the situation where they are denied the opportunities to return to a normal life. And then the third, and what this court has indicated in cases like Stonacek, is the most important factor. Whether or not that duty created by statute is applied to an individual privately or more towards the public at large. And I think looking to Stonacek creates a really effective juxtaposition in this case. In Stonacek, this court analyzed a statute that repeatedly referenced actions that a department had to take where a political subdivision didn't act appropriately. That is the polar opposite of what the court has in front of it today. In this case, the statute, 293528, specifically says what an individual must do. An individual has the right to file an action in Lancaster County District Court to compel the state's compliance. That could not be closer to the definition of what a private right is under the Claypool analysis.
Are you contending that this is an action compelling compliance in the language of the statute?
Absolutely. So the statute...
How so? This is a private action for damages, is it not?
It's a private action for damages along with seeking expungement of Mr. Doe's records. The statute doesn't state what compliance is going to be. Courts routinely order damages as a form of compelling compliance. The statute references the possibility of a mandamus action, but it's worth noting the entirety of the statute.
How does a damage order compel compliance? It doesn't compel compliance, right? It orders, instead of compelling compliance, the defendant is paying.
Well, the compelling compliance is by not incentivizing not to do it again in the future. And if you look
incentivizing is different than compelling, right?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that a reality is compelling is triggering something so it doesn't happen again.
Suppose, for purposes of argument, that we disagree with your argument that action for money damages is an attempt to compel compliance. Where does that take us?
Well, I think it creates a situation where you're still allowed to send this back to the district court looking at the expungement requirements that we asked for. Again, expungement seeks to compel compliance by not allowing the action to occur again. The problem with not allowing the statute to be read in its entirety, an action including but not limited to mandamus, and if you were to say locking it into mandamuses, you already have a situation where the state is violating a court order already. Bear in mind that in order to get to the point where the state is not allowed to release the records, Mr. Doe already had to obtain a court order, and that court order specifically had to seal his records.
I beg your pardon. Are you saying that mandamus is an ineffective approach?
In this particular case, yes. I think there are instances where it could be effective, and I think that the language of the statute vesting the ability to act in the private individual means that each individual on a case-by-case basis has the right and obligation to look at what they think is most likely to compel compliance. And different attorneys and different litigants might very well differ on what that means. There obviously would be litigants who would seek mandamus action, as this court has already addressed in the Riley case. And it's possible there are litigants who feel that a mandamus would in and of itself be sufficient. However, Mr. Doe did not feel that way. Mr. Doe felt the best option was to seek compelling compliance by seeking monetary damages, which would, again, compel the state not to do it again in the future, and an expungement of his record, which would, again, compel future compliance with the act so further expungements don't occur of other individuals.
Future compliance with respect to this particular individual?
Well, I think with...
How do you unring the bell?
That's exactly the problem. You can't unring the bell, and that's why the statute exists to allow Mr. Doe to compel some kind of compliance so it doesn't happen again in the future.
The enforcement provision that you've been talking about in 29-3528 has been in place using precisely the same language since 1978.
Correct.
So many years before the Criminal History Act was amended to address the situation that you bring to us today. What do we make of the fact that that language has been in place for so long and in the same fashion? How does that impact your argument?
I don't think it has an impact on my argument, really. I think the legislature saw we already have certain ramifications predating the 2018 modifications to the Act. We know what the penalty is for violation of these, and there are obviously several instances which don't apply in this case, which have applied for over 40 years now. The legislature said, I think, particularly since this all occurs after Riley, and the legislature again amended the Act in 2019, again after Riley, I think you take this to mean the legislature clearly intends to have a private duty here, because if they didn't, they would have changed something after the Riley case. Otherwise, the legislature would be facing a situation where they have a statute that literally means nothing if somebody can't bring a private action to compel the compliance.
Well, it doesn't mean nothing. There's still a legal obligation. There's all kinds of statutes that don't have private rights of action, are there not?
There are, but...
The state is still legally obligated to follow it. The question here is whether you can bring a private suit for damages.
Correct, but if the situation is there is no waiver of sovereign immunity in this court, said so in Riley, and there's no private right of action, then what kind of action can an individual bring? There's really no action an individual can bring at that point in time, and that's where you create the situation where the act effectively becomes meaningless. The other issue touched upon by the district court is part of it.
Before you move on, doesn't there also the remedy of the individual who wrongfully distributes this being subject to a criminal penalty?
In by way of separate statute, yes. So right. Section 27 provides for that. 28 provides for the ability for an individual to act.
And the criminal remedy, not the criminal remedy, the remedy we already discussed about the mandamus.
Correct.
Okay. So there are remedies in this set of statutes.
Correct, but again, without allowing for the private right of action, the separate remedy of that's provided for in 28 is nullified. There's nothing that can be done under that section. 27 is the one that addresses the criminal history aspect. Now, Your Honor, briefly, the other issue the district court touched upon was the issue of whether or not, because the information is true, Mr. Doe could not be harmed. We cited a number of instances in our brief, but I would posit to the court one that's not in our brief that may be most analogous is the Nebraska Trade Secret Act. Under that act, the dissemination of truthful information is exactly what makes it a violation. An individual comes across information in a limited scope of circumstances, they then disseminate it, and it's a violation of the act. It's the exact same situation here. The state has information under a limited set of circumstances. The state cannot disseminate that information because of state law and judicial order.
What is the nature of the relief you seek that you characterize as expungement?
That essentially, if there were a search for Mr. Doe's records, there would truly be nothing there as opposed to the sealed records.
Is there statutory authority for that?
Not within Nebraska law. However, as we cited in our brief, federal courts have recognized before that while it's an extraordinary remedy, it is an appropriate remedy in certain instances. And this, we feel, is a prime example of it. It would compel the state not to release the records again because it would not have the capacity.
Well, they're already compelled not to release them, correct?
They are barred by statute.
Yeah, that's the basis for this action. So what authority would a court have to go further than that and essentially destroy them?
And I think as the Fifth Circuit has noted, it is an authority the state has, that courts have, albeit an extraordinary one.
Isn't that an equitable remedy?
Yes, Your Honor.
And where in the statute would I find any intention of the legislature to provide for an equitable remedy?
Your Honor, I mean, I think inherently a mandamus action would flow on a certain level of equity that they're asking for.
Mandamus is an action of law, isn't it?
It is an action of law, but it has an inherent equitable quality for it. And depending on what the specific language of the order in mandamus is, again, it could be seeking a form of equitable relief.
But you didn't bring a mandamus action. You brought a tort action.
That is correct.
Is there any space for equity in a tort action under the State Tort Claims Act?
I think that within the confines of 3528, there is the ability to request for the equitable relief in spite of the fact that we've pled this as tort. I mean, part of the relief we are asking for is inherently equitable.
Does the Criminal History Act reference the State Tort Claims Act or vice versa? Do we have any indication from the legislature that they intended the two to communicate?
No, Your Honor.
And we have that in other instances, don't we?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. I would ask that this court reverse and remand with instructions to proceed to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Campbell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, James Campbell on behalf of the state appellees. Mr. Doe dislikes the limited remedy that the legislature has provided under the Criminal History Act, so he's asking this court to override it. Under the act, the legislature permits only actions to compel compliance. It has not provided for private civil tort liability. And as this court said in Stonasec, where the legislature has not provided for civil tort liability, it is prudent that courts not do so. Providing that relief anyways would raise serious separation of powers concerns, so we ask the court to affirm the lower court's decision. The central issue in this appeal is whether the Criminal History Act creates a tort duty. It does not, for the reasons we've explained in our brief. The primary factor that courts look to in that analysis is whether the legislature intended to create private tort liability. One key consideration is the stated statutory purpose. Here, the Criminal History Act gives us five stated purposes in the text of the act. When you look at those, none of them talk about creating private civil liability, certainly not tort liability. Rather, they all emphasize that the point was to create an efficient and effective administrative process for managing criminal history records. Mr. Doe talks a lot in his brief about the legislative history surrounding the 2018 amendments to the Criminal History Act. But there's nothing in that legislative history that talks about creating private civil tort liability. Whether you look to the statement of intent, which simply says that the intent was to require the sealing of these records for people who have obtained a pardon, or whether you look to all of the legislative testimony from the sponsor of the bill as well as all the proponents, no one said anything about creating private civil tort liability.
What's your view on the relevance of legislative history to this inquiry?
I don't think it's relevant. I bring it up simply to respond to the argument that is made. I think the most important consideration when trying to determine what the legislature intended is to look to the plain language of the statute. And here, the plain language of the statute, which not all statutes do, tells us what the purpose is. And given that none of those purposes was to create civil tort liability, I think that that is all the court needs to consider. The other primary consideration that courts look to in trying to determine whether the legislature intended to create private civil liability is whether there are explicit remedies. And here, there was some discussion earlier about the explicit remedy provided in the Criminal History Act. The Act says that an aggrieved person may bring an action, including but not limited to a mandamus action, to compel compliance. And that language, to compel compliance, is very, very important. What it means is that the statute permits enforcement actions ordering future conformity with the existing order not to disclose these records. That would include something like a mandamus action or potentially an injunctive action, but what it doesn't do is create civil tort liability, nor does it provide for someone to get damages. And I think it's helpful to juxtapose that language with other statutes. There are many other statutes, as this court is well aware, that talk about the remedies available to someone that brings an action.
And one, so how would the remedies work in this case? The cat was already out of the bag, wasn't it?
The cat was, according to the allegations, which as the court will know if from our answer, we deny those allegations, but assuming, as we must, under the standard of review, that the allegations are true, then the cat would have been out of the bag. However, I think that if there's a problem with the limitation on the remedy, then the solution is to go to the legislature and to ask them to broaden the remedy. But a remedy to bring an action to compel compliance does not include anything other than an order compelling compliance, which, as I said, could be a mandamus action, it could be an injunction, which would require the state official in the future not to further disclose anything and would include increasing punishments if they were to do that.
Would it be limited, pardon me, to Doe, or would it be somehow broader?
Well,
Do it again as to Doe. Don't do it again as to other individuals.
I think if the lawsuit was brought by Doe, then just standard principles of injunctive relief is that it could only run to the plaintiff that brought the lawsuit. So I think it would be don't do it again as to Doe. But again, the statute itself provides already an order, don't disseminate this information. And so what this remedy does is it provides an additional statement, an additional order, an additional penalty saying you cannot disclose this information. But again, if that is too limited of a remedy, then the solution is to go back to the legislature and to ask the legislature to broaden it. But this is the remedy that we've had since 1978. We see no evidence anywhere that anyone has ever brought a damages claim using this provision, and for good reason, because when the legislature wants to allow for a damages claim, it includes different language. Like, for instance, there are many statutes that use the phrase appropriate relief, that you may bring an action to recover appropriate relief. That broad language is not what was used here. Instead, there's specific language, and that does not provide for the kind of tort liability that Mr. Doe is arguing for.
What do you make of the part of the statutory scheme that says essentially you can lie about your background? Is that relevant to anything we're doing here?
The only way in which it's relevant, in my opinion, is that it does provide a form of a remedy. Now, it's certainly not a remedy from a court, but it does tell the individual who's seeking to protect their criminal history that if they are asked a question in violation of the statute, that they're allowed to essentially respond as if no criminal history exists, even if that is not technically true. So I do think it's a form of remedy, although I acknowledge that it is not the type of remedy that a court provides. And so for that reason, I don't think it's directly relevant to what we're dealing with in this case.
To the extent Mr. Doe is seeking expungement, is that an action to compel compliance?
I don't believe it is. A couple points on the expungement issue. The first one is it's waived. It was mentioned in an assignment of error, but it was not argued in the substance of the opening brief, and so I think the issue is waived. But the second issue, which I think is really important, is that this statute actually talks about expungement, and it's subsection 9 of the relevant provision we're talking about. And it provides for expungement only when you're dealing with an arrest record that resulted from the error of a police officer. So given that the legislature has shown us that they know how to provide for expungement if they want to, and they've done it in a situation that is not the one at issue here. So I think that tells the court that the court does not have the power to order expungement. And to distinguish the cases that Mr. Doe relies on for this inherent power to expunge his records, those cases, when you look at them, he specifically cites a Second Circuit decision. I believe it was Schneck is the name of it, in his reply brief. And if you look at that case, what you'll find is that federal law in those circumstances did not address the issue of expungement. And so the court said, in the absence of a statute dealing with it, we'll find that we have the inherent authority to address it. The problem here is the legislature has addressed expungement in this law, and it specifically said it's available in one circumstance, but not in this. And so for that reason, I don't think that's relief that the court could order.
Even following a pardon, aren't there certain entities that are entitled to receive the information about the underlying criminal matters, like other criminal justice entities? And if you expunge it or destroy the records, they would no longer have access to those?
I think that is a very relevant point, and that's probably one reason why the legislature didn't provide for widespread expungement, why it only picked that one specific set of circumstances when an arrest record was created because of an error made by the police, and that's the only instance in which you can get an expungement. So I do think that reflects.
I beg your pardon. Can you remind me, is this correct that the trial court found no jurisdiction because it was a discretionary act under the Tort Claims Act?
That is correct. That's an aspect of the lower court's decision. And so the lower court had two opinions.
So if that were correct, then we wouldn't go forward with the rest of the analysis? If it was discretionary and there's no jurisdiction, then we're not proceeding to some of this other statutory analysis. Is that right?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it actually runs the other way. And so the statutory analysis we're talking about now, which is whether there is a duty created by the Criminal History Act, that core question would resolve the whole case, because if there isn't a duty,
that would inform whether or not that which they did was discretionary?
Well, the discretionary holding only applied to a few of the defendants, specifically the Correctional Services Department as well as Director Frakes.
Thank you.
And so if you uphold that, you're only upholding a part of the dismissal of the case.
Thank you.
And so if you instead address the duty question first, that would resolve the whole case.
Given the nature of the tort claim, the negligence that's been alleged here, is there a private parallel or a private analog in Nebraska law?
A private analog for a negligence claim?
For the one that's been alleged here. Could a private person be liable in negligence, in tort, for the claim that's alleged here
for the violation
the state
of the Criminal
defendant.
History Act?
Yes.
Yeah. When you asked that question, I did take a look at the statute, and my sense is that no, there wouldn't be a claim under the Criminal History Act for a violation of it. Because
what is the impact of that to our subject matter jurisdiction analysis?
Well, I think the impact of it is that there's potentially a number. I think one that's very important is one thing the lower court talked about, which I think was absolutely correct, is that the lens through which this case has to be viewed is through the waiver of sovereign immunity. And the reason why that's so is because this claim was brought against state defendants in their sovereign capacity, and because it was brought into the State Tort Claims Act, which is the only way you can bring a negligence claim against the state. And so for that reason, I think if it's a close call on whether there's a duty here and whether the legislature intended to create a private civil tort liability, I think the fact that we construe waivers of sovereign immunity in favor of the state, I think that, to say it very sort of colloquially, a tie goes to the state here. So if it's a close call, I think that that's one factor, and that's one way in which it affects the analysis, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Seeing I have no more time, we would ask the court to affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, counsel. That concludes arguments on Doe versus State of Nebraska.